are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are privileged to be interviewing Dan Shawn. He's an acclaimed author of 6 books, both novels and short stories, National Book Award nominee. Look anywhere in places where wonderful short stories are published and you'll find Dan's work. And he is coming to Port Townsend to the Port Townsend Writers Conference. He's going to be on the faculty and really heading up the fiction section this year. Now, the Port Townsend Writers Conference is every year in mid-July, this year from July 16th to 23rd. And if you're listening to this show after the conference has gone by, please go to the Centrum website and you will find information about writers' residencies and all kinds of other activities for budding poets and writers that you can take advantage of. So, I think Dan is waiting to talk to us, so welcome, Dan.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to start today with a reading from your latest novel, Ill Will. And just to give our listeners just a sense of the kind of writing that you are so well known for.
Okay, I'm just going to read a little chapter that kind of gives some idea of one of the main threads in the book.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I started talking to my Uncle Rusty about 6 months ago. This was after he was released from prison, after most of the stuff that my dad had testified at the trial was proved to have been a lie. Also about a year and a half after my mom died. He kept his distance for a while. "I don't want to intrude," Rusty said. "I mean, yeah, it's a lot to deal with. I want to give you all some space." Not that it mattered. No one would talk to him. Not my father. Not my Aunt Kate. He had nobody in the world. They just put him out at the prison gates and the government didn't make reparations for what they'd done to him. They didn't even give an apology. Basically, he got so screwed there are no words for it. His trial had happened back during the 1980s when the idea of satanic ritual abuse got very popular. That's how he put it. "Yeah, the idea of satanic ritual abuse got very popular," he said. "And it made me think of a crowd of eager fans rushing toward a stage as if satanic ritual abuse were a rock band. I'd never heard of that term before. Satanic ritual abuse? It sounded so corny that I kind of chuckled until he explained it to me, and then I started doing some internet searches. According to the World Wide Web, satanic ritual abuse was basically an urban legend, a moral panic, according to Wikipedia, which the people of the 1980s started to believe was real. Seems like a lot of people accepted it as truth, that there were hidden satanic cults all over the country secretly doing human sacrifices and torturing children and calling Satan up in a graveyard. There was actually a news special on television exposing Satan's underground, which you can watch on YouTube." Okay, that's probably a good place to stop.
That's great. So this book, it's incredibly scary. It's very complex.
Thank you.
It's incredible.
I'm excited to hear that.
Oh, man. I could only read it from 10 to noon. It's very complex, and it is totally addictive. So for people like me that kind of avoid, let's say, this kind of horror, scary thriller,
uh-huh.
This is different. I'm talking to our audience now because it's really well written. It's not really graphically horrible. It's just wonderfully on the edge of your seat. So I'm telling you, if you're afraid of this kind of book, this is a good place to kind of get started. And you know, later on,
I love being the the baby step into horror.
No, yeah, the baby step into horror. Okay, so we are talking to Dan Shawn, and he is a New York Times bestselling author. Believe me, it wasn't hard to find lots of reviews and lots of interviews with Dan as I was preparing for this show. He lives in Cleveland. He teaches at Oberlin. So there are two very different settings for you. Which setting do you prefer to use, Dan? Cleveland?
Cleveland, I think.
Yes. And also, you don't go to happy places. You're writing, you know, it seems to me, about the people that, dare I say it, maybe on the edge of Trump world, or maybe even aren't even thinking about politics, because their lives are very much on the edge of what we consider the happy American dream society.
When the book starts out, I've got a character who's a psychologist. He's married to a lawyer. He lives in a nice suburb.
Mm-hmm.
Everything seems basically fine for him. And then, you know, things start to unravel. But there definitely are things in the book that are about sort of the margins of society. There's stuff about prison and foster care. There's stuff about growing up poor. And there's stuff about the opioid epidemic, particularly heroin, which is, you know, in Ohio at least, a real disaster and something that I've been thinking about a lot.
It's quickly revealed that Rusty, the foster brother, is going to be released. And, you know, when we hear those stories on the news, we kind of go, wow, this is great. But then you twist it and, you know, we find out more about Rusty and about Dustin, Dr. Dustin Tillman, his younger brother, and the fact that he has been in prison because their parents were murdered, and that's, he was accused of that. So right away, these human fears, really the fears that we have of being parents, of being married and wondering about our spouses, you are so in touch with that. Do you write about your own experiences in life? Do those things come up for you?
In some ways, I do, although, you know, my parents were not murdered in a satanic ritual. I don't know anything about heroin use. I've never tried it. You know, I've never searched for a serial killer. So all of those things are fiction. At the same time, there are elements that are, you know, that are drawing on my own life. I think all writers have to have sort of a kernel or a core of autobiographical emotion that they're drawing on. And in particular, you know, I think this book is drawing on my experience with losing a spouse. Mm. My wife died in 2008. Mm. My experience with raising two teenage sons who have asked me to say in any interview that the sons in Ill Will are not them.
I never thought that.
And also, you know, my experience growing up in a fairly poor rural part of western Nebraska, which I draw on a lot, and my experience with growing up with foster kids. You know, I have all of those things that are in my background, and I've taken them and kind of used them as sort of an engine to power this very strange, very creepy, almost supernaturally weird book.
Yes, I totally agree. I would say for people that have been watching the current Sherlock series with Cumberbatch, you just got to keep your wits about you because you don't know what's coming up. And that's definitely that's definitely true in this book. Was there a true crime or a story also that you not only took your own personal themes, but a serial killer that you read about, or?
Right. There were really two things that I was drawing on. One is the satanic panic of the 1980s, when there was all this hysteria about Satanism and the murders and child abuse being conducted by these, you know, secretive groups. Oh. There were some famous trials revolving around that sort of witch hunt period. I was also drawn to this death that happened when my brother-in-law was a student back in the early 2000s. There was a drowning death on his campus. A kid left, you know, a bar and disappeared and ended up a few days later drowned in the river. And the police said that it was just a death by misadventure. You know, the kid was drunk. He fell in the river and drowned. But the students got very upset and concerned about this, and they just didn't think that things added up, and they began to believe that there was a killer on the loose. And then they began to collect all of these related deaths, and they decided that it was a serial killer. And I was fascinated because I felt like I was right at ground zero of the creation of an urban legend or of a conspiracy theory. I could see how all of this stuff was getting built up in these students' minds, and how they were able to connect things that probably more than likely weren't really connected at all.
Right.
And that was really compelling to me, and I knew that's something that I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about the ways in which we try to make sense of the world, and we try to figure out a way to make things connect and make sense, even when they may just be random.
There are three storylines going on in this book, and you also write in the first person, the second person, the third person. I'm wondering...
Yeah, it's a mess.
Well, I know, but it's just so... That's what keeps it really riveting, because you have to keep thinking about it. You can't mindlessly read this book. It's definitely a page-turner. How do you feel about being considered a genre writer? I mean, you know, sometimes people might just say, oh, he writes thrillers.
On the one hand, I did grow up reading books that are considered thrillers, and, you know, among those were... Shirley Jackson, The Haunting of Hill House, which I think is a classic genre novel, but it's also a novel that was nominated for the National Book Award, and Shirley Jackson is currently the subject of a lot of attention and revival. There was just a biography of her that came out that was very well received. Another person that I really admired was Peter Straub, who I think is, you know, he's known as a horror writer, but I think he's also a literary writer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I mean, I think the line between what is genre and what isn't genre is shifting a lot. And whether we take genre to be something that's a little trashy, or whether we just take it to mean, okay, it's about this kind of subject or about this kind of feeling. I mean, for example, I mean, if you want to use the term comedy, that can mean stupid Adam Sandler type stuff with lots of slapstick, or it can mean Vladimir Nabokov's Panin, which is, you know, a very beautiful novel. So, I mean, I think genre doesn't necessarily mean what people kind of sometimes assume it means. I guess I take on the mantle of being a thriller writer or a horror writer with some pride, and, you know, because those writers were my kin when I was growing up.
So I feel like these are very psychological. So when you're writing, what are the hooks for you that keep you writing for long periods of time that it takes to finish a novel? Are you an outliner? Do you just follow one strand and then go to another one? Kind of describe your process for us.
Well, I mean, I actually feel like one of the things that keeps me writing is not necessarily knowing what's going to happen next, and also having a sense that the characters, as I'm getting to know them and as I'm writing about them, are developing depth and are learning more about them has a surprise in store for me as well. So I have, you know, kind of a general idea when I start writing a novel. I kind of know what the beginning is and what the end is going to be, and I kind of have an idea of what the structure is going to feel like. But within that kind of general map, I have a lot of stuff that I don't know, and that's one of the things that keeps me writing, is trying to figure stuff out and also looking forward to some of the things that will surprise me.
We're talking to Dan Shaun. He's the author of Among the Missing and You Remind Me of Me. We're talking about his current book, Ill Will, and also he has another short story collection called Stay Awake. And Stay Awake is, the Washington Post said, the scariest book of the year. And I loved reading these short stories. They didn't sort of completely throw me into another, to a tailspin of fearing like Ill Will did. And I had a lot of fun reading Stay Awake. So these do harken back to, you know, Shirley Jackson, to The Lottery, to Ray Bradbury. What are some of your influences for your short story writing?
You mentioned Ray Bradbury, and he was somebody that I read when I was a kid, and I particularly liked, I don't think he's as well known for his scary stories as he is for his science fiction stories, but he wrote a lot of kind of scary stories, particularly in a book called October Country, and that was a book that I read a lot. I also really admire Ray Carver. So in some ways, I'd like to say that I'm trying to meld those two strands together. Other writers that I like include Alice Munro and Kelly Link. So, you know, I feel like I have a lot of influences that are coming from different directions that I'm trying to figure out a way to braid.
So there was one particular story which was very visually clear for me, Patrick Lane flabbergasted. Tell us a little bit about that story and that character and where he is and what happens to him without revealing
the
story.
Okay, so this is a kid. I think this story came from like a news report about millennials moving home in record numbers, you know, so they leave college and they move back home in record numbers. And I felt a lot of sympathy and interest in this idea of, you know, the kind of failure to launch, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing this story about this kid who has dropped out of college. He's living in his parents' house. And while he's living with them, they commit suicide, and he's stuck with the process of like selling the house and trying to solve all of these adult problems. And slowly he's beginning to collapse under the weight of all of these responsibilities. And also he's beginning to feel like the house is haunted, that there's something really, really wrong, but he can't quite put his finger on it. So it's like, I think it's kind of a funny story. Do you?
It is. Well, yes. And the fact...
I mean, it doesn't sound funny when I'm describing it.
Okay. So, I mean, he ends up kind of downstairs on the sofa with all of his, you know, his video games and his whatever devices he has. They're all surrounding him, protecting him. And what I found funny was thinking of him trying to fix the bathroom upstairs. And,
right.
And because haven't we all been there where we unscrew something and like the new thing won't fit in back and you're kind of going, oh my God, I'm going to have to call the plumber. Well, poor Patrick, you know, he doesn't call the plumber. He just kind of shuts the door.
He just gives up and I think he actually boards the bathroom door closed at
right,
one point.
Right. He's giving up parts of the house. And meanwhile, his lawyer sister is calling and saying, well, how's it going? We need to sell this house. And it's just falling apart around him. We won't talk about... That's the funny part. And so, you know, I kind of see him in Detroit or maybe parts of Cleveland, you know.
It's Cleveland.
Yeah, it's Cleveland. But for people who aren't familiar with, you know, kind of the Rust Belt, you've all seen pictures of what's happening in various neighborhoods in Detroit and can imagine it. Then there's another story called The Bees. And this one has a little bit more of the ghostly and, you know, the evil spirit haunting, the malicious spirit being
mm-hmm.
there. Tell us a little bit about The Bees. It's an incredible story.
It starts out with a guy who has a wife and a son, and he's kind of happily married, excited about his life, but he also has a dark past. When he was younger, he was an alcoholic and he abandoned his other family, a wife and child. And now, in the midst of his new life, there's something strange going on with his son. His son has been waking up with night terrors, and it's very frightening to Gene, and it also brings up all of these memories about this family that he abandoned. Mm-hmm. And soon he begins to feel as if there's a sinister aspect to that family that he abandoned, that in some ways they're haunting him. Well, things get worse from there.
Yes. And that you're laughing.
I shouldn't laugh.
No, I know. But once again, it's the kind of hook, it's the kind of story that really pushes our human buttons. You know, as parents, as people that are trying so hard to make everything good for our kids, but you know, there's trouble out there, and we try to just push on by it. So one of my questions is, do you think about your readers and how your books are affecting them as you're writing?
I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for some people, or maybe for many people, reading a scary book or reading something that's sad, or listening to sad music for that matter, performs a kind of dialysis for us. And we kind of need those things to as a container for all of the feelings that we've been sort of bottling up in our daily lives. And I feel like that's something that's really important to me. I love scary movies. I feel great after I leave watching them, and I feel like I've purged myself somehow. At the same time, I'm also aware that it's a flavor, right? It's like butterscotch or licorice or whatever, you either like it or you don't. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm perfectly happy for people who don't need this kind of thing to not read my books, because you know it is something that's, you know, that is, I mean, they're disturbing books, and they deal with, you know, fairly disturbing topics. I was talking to somebody the other day about David Lynch, who's a director that I really love, and you know, I just watched the new Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And I was totally in heaven.
Filmed here in the dark Northwest.
Yes. And, you know, then I was talking to a friend who was like, that was the worst thing I've ever seen. It's so stupid and crazy. And I was like, oh, well, I mean, you know, I didn't try to argue with him, because in one way, he's right. I mean, if you're not enjoying that kind of feeling, you're just not enjoying it. I guess that's what I think about. I mean, I'm not setting out to be somebody that pleases every reader.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yes,
but
it does.
I do know I have readers that are really going to get something out of my books and that really want that thing.
So
does that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. I get that, and I get the sense of release of, you know, if you're harboring these kind of waking up in the middle of the night terrors about your family, or you're not sure about your significant other and the relationship, you know, these kinds of books are psychological, and they can help you think about them and maybe confront them.
Right. Well, you can always say to yourself, at least I'm not in a Dan Shaun novel.
That's true. That's true. So I do want to talk about the Port Townsend Writing Conference, and because you spend a great deal, you've spent a lot of time writing, but you also spend a lot of time teaching. So you are going to be here for a week, and you're going to be doing a workshop that's described as generative fiction writing workshop. It's called Dreaming Awake. Tell our audience what you're planning for this workshop.
Well, I do a lot of in-class writing, and I have a lot of exercises that help students to create stories and find characters and just discover new ways of writing. I'm really interested in the way that our imagination works. I call the class Dreaming Awake because that's what I think of when I'm writing fiction, that there is this kind of dream state that you can get into, and that it is accessible. It's not, I mean, I think a lot of times people think of it as mystical or something, but it's actually very accessible. And I think it's something that people do naturally. When we're little kids, we become attached to some object, and that, you know, like a blanket or a stuffed animal, and that object begins to take on a lot of psychological weight. It becomes, you know, it has a personality. It goes on adventures. You know, there's all kinds of things that happen to that object. And this happens even when we're pre-verbal. We're telling these stories. We're kind of dreaming through these stories. And you know, it might happen to you in the supermarket, where the woman in front of you is wearing a gold, shiny wig. You're not going to ask her, but you're just thinking, I wonder what she was thinking when she put that on this morning, and where is she going? And pretty soon you've got a pretty complicated story. Long after you've lost sight of the woman, you're thinking about, you know, a kind of story of where she was before and where she's going to go. And that's what fiction is. It's this kind of daydreaming that we do, and it's a little more focused than that probably. But that's what I'm interested in, and that's what I'm interested in exploring with my students.
Well, I have a student here in the studio with me. He's the engineer of the show today. His name is Jacob Brown, and he's interested in asking you a question.
I've been enjoying listening to you talk so far. You kind of answered this earlier, but how do you get into that mindset to bring out what you put to paper? Because I know I have to get into the mindset to write whatever I'm going to write. I know I've got to think about my characters, think about the scene, and think about how they would react.
Right.
And how do you get to that point?
It doesn't really help me to sit and stare out the window. I used to do that a lot and, you know, like hope for the muse to come down and tap me with her magic wand. I've actually found I create a music playlist that will kind of get me in the mood. Then I'll set a timer for a certain amount of time, and I will just start writing. And I I think that rather than going from, you know, like your logical brain to the page, free writing and writing on a timer really allows things to emerge in a way that is surprising to you. And, you know, you may not get good stuff every time, but if you keep doing it, you'll begin to get good stuff over time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I like the idea of creating a playlist. And for our listeners, you can go to YouTube and look up Danshan and find the playlist for the novel Ill Will, which I think is a lot of fun. We're going to play, I think, the Modest Mouse cut during this program, Strangers to Ourselves, which is the intro. Am I correct about that?
That was my intro. For every time I sat down to write, I would play that Modest Mouse song, and it would get me in. It was almost Pavlovian. It would get me in the mood. Now when I hear it, it's weird because I almost feel this kind of urge to start writing Ill Will, even though it's over. So I maybe have ruined the song for myself.
Well, there's more songs out there.
Yes, absolutely.
You are listening to KPTZ. This is Book Lovers Cafe, and we've been talking to Danshan, and we could talk to him for another half hour. So there's so much to talk about his books and his techniques, and please take advantage of going to the Port Townsend Writers Conference. There are free readings and lectures every night. You can find the information on the Centrum website. You know, and then we have the fabulous Anna Quinn at Writers Workshop that has authors coming in all during the year. I think Dan will be at the Northwest Art Center right there on Water Street, and they have readings every month as well. So here we are in wonderful Port Townsend and welcoming all the authors that are coming for the Port Townsend Writing Conference. Thank you so much, Dan. I look forward to meeting you in person and being at that reading in a couple weeks.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen to past shows and other programs from our podcast page, kptz.org. I'd really like to thank Jacob Brown for being the engineer. Bye for now.
Have designed more unusual things as yet.